TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The U.S. Government's Role in the Murder of Martin Luther King. A one-hour lecture by John Judge. Today you will hear part one. The growth of secret intelligence organizations in the U.S. from World War I to 9/11. John Judge is an acclaimed researcher and lecturer. He is co-founder of the Committee for Open Archives and the Coalition on Political Assassinations. In the aftermath of Oliver Stone's movie, he helped draft legislation that led to the declassification of government documents on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He is now working on legislation to declassify documents relating to the life, work, and the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Unlike some in the room, although some of you may, I recall where I was when Dr. King was killed. I was in college in University of Dayton in Ohio. I used to go back into the classroom buildings at night to study and read, because it was quiet, well lit. And I was in one of the rooms and heard out in the hallway, a cleaning woman had a cart with a little radio on it, and it was announcing that Dr. King had been shot in Memphis. By that point, I was already steeped in working on the John F. Kennedy assassination. I was reading the Warren Commission volumes at the library at school. And I remember going out in the hallway and the woman standing there, you know, stuck on the cart and crying. We were already vigiling on the campus against the war in Vietnam. I called the people to the vigil, and we had a vigil the next day. I made a sign that said, "The King of Love is dead." And I understood the importance of Dr. King's movement and his nonviolence and his shift, which he got a lot of heat for, from merely dealing with the civil rights movement and putting it in the broader context. Dr. King said that there were three pillars of oppression in the society, and they all had to be addressed. Racism was one, poverty was another, and militarism was the third. And a year to the day before he died, as Doug mentioned, in Riverside Church, King gave a speech coming out against the Vietnam War, a reaction in part to the work of Dr. William Pepper, who in those days was an independent journalist in Vietnam, who had taken pictures that were printed in Ramparts magazine in an issue called The Children of Vietnam that showed the damage done by napalm to the children of Vietnam in the war. And when Dr. King saw the photos, he pushed his food aside and said that he could no longer remain silent about the war. But speaking against the war and moving in that direction put him in a direct path with the elements in intelligence and in the Pentagon and the other intelligence agencies that did not want the rise of a black messiah, as the COINTELPRO documents from the FBI said. They did not want leadership going in that direction. In addition to that, Dr. King, in the last year of his life, began to move toward organizing a poor people's march to Washington, D.C., that was not going to march solely, but was going to sit in the shadow of the Capitol until things changed in this country. And they understood what draw he had, what power he had to lead that, the moral authority that he had garnered from his movement. They saw him as a dangerous leader. When Martin Luther King came close to Malcolm X and began to work with Malcolm on the poverty issues and to agree to that I would argue is some, not all, but some of the momentum for the death of Malcolm X as well, who was assassinated as part of these plots. The spying on Dr. King actually dates back to an earlier period than just when he made these radical moves. And the early spying on civilians in this country for political purpose really begins in earnest at the end of World War I, some during World War I, but primarily at the end of World War I, when an individual by the last name of Vandeman in Army intelligence begins to collect files on radicals, on communists, on political activists, but they were also looking at race politics. And files were opened that long ago, in the period right after World War I, on Dr. King's grandfather. And so they were surveilling the King family all through those years, as well as other people who, even as ministers or people in the community, were providing some sort of leadership or a potential to organize people. And it was Vandeman's files that led to the Palmer raids in the 1920s and the attacks on communists and mass deportations and also attacks in the courts and phony charges against much of the immigrant community that came into the United States at that point and that shared the radical politics of the era, because the industrialists and the monarchists were very frightened by the Russian Revolution. They did not want it to spread. Herbert Hoover, who spent more time in Europe than the United States, became president of the United States later, set up a fund, first to fund the White Russian response to the Bolsheviks and to try to undermine the revolution, and then created an international fund with the monarchists and the big industrialists across the world to fund a secret rearmament of Germany from 1918 to 1932, which led to the drive back to Moscow under Hitler and the final attempt for a direct attack on the Soviet Union. And these elements were operating sort of with that philosophy and bringing it into a domestic context. So it is Vandeman that then provides the files to a young government employee, John Edgar Hoover, and then forces the Congress to create a federal police that he headed up. The trend in the direction that leads to Martin Luther King's death fortifies itself then at the end of World War II. During World War II, two people come over to the FBI in 1942 from the Office of Naval Intelligence, which is the oldest and largest intelligence unit in the United States, and almost unknown. DIA, most people don't know those initials. Defense Intelligence Agency has 80% of the intelligence budget and has many more employees than the FBI and the CIA combined. You can find 100 books, 200 books on the CIA. I challenge you to find 10 books on the DIA, the ONI, the NSA, the NRO, and the elements that really run the intelligence in this country. The CIA is a think tank, but when it wants something done, it has to go to military intelligence to get it done, because they have the equipment and the guns. They have the expertise. And so these elements were growing, but the ONI came over understanding that eventually what would emerge from World War II was a broader intelligence system. World War II, in its final stages, I would argue, what became entirely an intelligence war that was won not by military force but by intelligence manipulation. And that put the intelligence agencies, not only the United States, but in other countries, in the cat's seat in terms of making decisions after the war. In addition to that, there was complete cross-penetration between Nazi intelligence, British intelligence, U.S. intelligence. We didn't have the capability to do the kind of intelligence around the world that the Brits did. They had run empire for hundreds of years, you know, and they understood how colonialization worked, and so we used them to train us. The charter of the American CIA was written by Sir William Stevenson and Ian Fleming, who later wrote the James Bond books at the end of the war. They brought British intelligence here and combined them with the FBI. The FBI had international functions at that point. But in 1942, two people come over from the Office of Naval Intelligence. It's also important in terms of when you're hearing Doug say that the mafia paid for the assassination of Dr. King. You should understand that the mafia is nothing more than errand boys in terms of how this system operates. And the connections between organized crime and organized intelligence begin in World War II with the protection, supposedly, of the mob against German saboteurs in the docks of New York. And it's a connection that eventually releases Lucky Luciano from prison. From prison, he sends his scarf to General Patton, who shows his double L scarf to Don Caligaro Vizzini up in the hills above Palermo, and they travel through Sicily at a fast rate. They called it Lucky Forward. Well, it's Lucky Luciano Forward because they're making a deal with the mafia, who are chased into the hills by Mussolini, to come back down out of those hills, but it allows them to establish a base in Sicily and then come down into the cities and take over Italy in the middle of World War II. And those connections maintain into the post war period. There's CIA and OSS connections with organized crime to make sure that the post-world, post-World War II globe doesn't go communist. They have mafia goons beating up strikers in Marseille at the end of the war, for instance, or moving in places where they're in danger of communists being elected into power after World War II, because some of the history of the resistance to World War II centers itself among communists and people of a left persuasion, and they didn't want those people to rise out of that struggle in the end, having defeated the Nazis and the fascists, to rise then into state power. So the Office of Naval Intelligence provides two people to Hoover to tell him basically that when this new post-World War intelligence arises, when the OSS then eventually becomes the CIA, they will protect his turf. They will make sure that he's in charge of domestic spying, CIA only spies abroad, and he's not going to be completely threatened by these new developments. Their names are Kartha Deek Deloach and William Sullivan from ONI. And these are two names, if you know anything about COINTELPRO, they form the Domestic Operation Division, or the FBI, and they run the counterintelligence program against the left, against the civil rights movement, against black leadership in this country, against the peace movements and the anti-war movements, against all different kinds of expressions of democratic sentiment or sentiments against oppression, begin to be not only surveilled but infiltrated, bad-jacketed, as they call it, rumors, pitted against each other so that you can use one section to kill the other. You have provocateur agents that go in and create criminal situations that the police can then respond to. You look into non-criminal groups for what they're doing. Eventually, these things were challenged in the 70s by the Frank Church Committee in the Senate, and there were hearings and there were rules passed to stop the abuses. But post 9/11, all those have been blown away. In fact, in the news commentary in the days after 9/11, the first thing blamed for 9/11 was the Frank Church Committee, that we had tied the hands of the FBI and the CIA by not letting them spy on civilians and all of that, and so they needed to have their powers back. And it was interesting to me that when the pundits were arguing this, at one point they went over and a spokesperson from the CIA said, well, these people are misled, we don't need those legal authorities. And they don't, because they operate without them. In fact, a hitman doesn't want a legal authority to assassinate people, because then he doesn't have a level of deniability. If you're killing people after they make it legal to kill people, then they're going to know who's doing it. And so it's better to maintain a sort of covert illegality about things where they're not openly assented to. So you have President Ford, executive order saying that they can't go abroad and assassinate people unless it's for a reason of national security. That little tagline is still inside the executive order. And of course, there's always some reason that things have to do with national security. The NSA develops Operation Harvest by the 1980s, where they can simultaneously tap 450,000 telephones at the same time in any given area. And then they have computers listen to the tapes of the phones for key words. And then they harvest out the lines that they want to listen to more often. And then they start listening to those and see if they get more multiplication of key words until they get down to the few phones that they want to tap all the time and that they want human ears to listen to. That's Operation Harvest, to get to the top of the pyramid. So they say, well, do you think you're tapping your phone? Everybody gets to get their phone tapped at some point, at least for a while. And people, I don't worry about it, because my attitude is the people listening to me with those human ears are on the lowest level of the need-to-know chain. Maybe they'll learn something. The boss ain't going to tell them why they're there. That framework was in place, and its warnings against the ability of black leadership to rise at the time of the civil rights movement and through the anti-war period and on into the 70s, and many organizations were disrupted and destroyed. Much of the capability of the left and progressive movements was disrupted in the 1960s. It's, I think, sort of cachet now to say, oh, well, they tried all those things and they don't work. But we didn't just try them and they didn't work. They made sure they didn't work. Okay, and they did things to destroy what could have been a broader movement, and was seen by them as an insurgency, as a literal insurgency. May 1970, when people came to D.C. to shut the town down in the demonstration, they're eventually locked up in the stadiums in an illegal mass arrest. But they had troops in the tunnels beneath the White House ready to come up armed and protect the White House if need be. But when the officer told the troops to lock and load, they refused as a whole unit. And that was happening in Vietnam. On the ground, too, units began to refuse to fire at Vietnamese that they saw out in the field. They just let them pass. They started refusing in units and sitting down. They stood up to the officers. They disobeyed the orders. And by the end of the war, they began killing the officers so that the lifespan of a new second lieutenant was shorter than a paratroop medic. And they began to, as they call, fragging them with fragmentation grenades. But they had a revolt on their hands in the field there, and they had a similar problem here. The first demonstration that I knew about in the anti-war movement against Vietnam came out of Harlem. It was, Malcolm X had a hand in organizing it. And the organizing slogan, if you'll pardon my French, is no Vietnamese ever called me nigger. People of color were going and seeing that the conditions for the poor and people of color in Vietnam were not different, and the way they were treated was not different than they were being treated at home. And that the connection was that they were fighting a war that didn't represent their ultimate interests within the society at home. And the promises of World War II were already being eroded from the troops that came back then and were trying to use their military duty as a grounds for citizenship or assimilation into the society were already being corrupted. And they weren't given the kind of power that they needed. And so all of these three things, the racism, the poverty, and the militarism, were being addressed by these movements. And they literally saw it as a potential for revolutionary change, and they were frantic on how to stop it. And I don't think they knew how effectively to stop Dr. King. I think the killing him, in a sense, is their admission that they could not disrupt his movement or dismantle it, that he had a moral and political authority that they couldn't overcome. Of course, by killing him, they didn't kill the legacy that he left. And in the end, they can't kill the truth because there are always more of us than we can think. But they targeted Dr. King, and among the documents that I sent to Doug Valentine that we had gotten loose, in part from the John F. Kennedy assassination records collection, we passed an act in 1992 following the Oliver Stone film JFK, which ended with the thing saying that the documents were still locked up, which meant that thousands of letters and calls went to Congress saying, why don't you release these documents on JFK? Since there had always been a vast majority of people in the country didn't believe the Warren Commission, believed that there was a conspiracy in the John F. Kennedy case, and so they wanted the records released. And that led to us being able to push through a law that for the first time had an impact. The Freedom of Information Act, which was really created to look at corporate files, wasn't working on national security files because the agency itself had to decide to release its own secrets. The agency itself would decide whether there was national security involved. The Freedom of Information Act has many clauses under which you can deny release of a file, and it could be withheld forever. The John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Act, on the other hand, has a presumption of release, an independent review board that makes the decision to release the record. The agencies can appeal to the president, but it's the same president that has appointed the board. And it also has very few conditions under which you can postpone release of a record or part of a record, that you're identifying an existing agent that's still operating or a source or method that's currently being used. It can't be just that something's embarrassing from the past. Under the Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits from 1964 till 1994, we got loose about 2,000 pages on the John F. Kennedy assassination that had been classified. From 1994, when the board was finally formed for the JFK Act, until the present, and the process isn't ended yet, we have 6.5 million pages released, one of the largest releases of classified documents in U.S. history. We were just recently outstripped by a similarly structured independent board for the Nazi War Crimes Records Act, which has released 8.5 million pages to date. And the bill that I helped work on for Cynthia McKinney, two bills actually now, were based on the JFK Records Act, and one is a Martin Luther King Records Act, which was introduced two Congresses ago when she was going out of office and didn't have any legs, and then we reintroduced it in the current Congress last March. Since then, we've gotten 62 co-sponsors for the bill, and just recently on April the 4th, without any press release, Senator Kerry from here in Massachusetts introduced a companion bill in the Senate. We know that 600,000 to 700,000 pages exist in the House Select Committee assassination study from the 1970s on the King assassination. It is locked up otherwise till 2028. We believe that there are other federal not only federal but state and local government records regarding King. And this is not solely a bill about King's assassination. It's a bill to release the records on his life, activities, and death. So it's a broader bill than the Kennedy bill. But you're also facing a machinery of classification that is going at a much faster rate than anything we can throw at it. And while these are the largest releases, they are merely a dent. As an example, in 2004, 16.4 million records. When I say records, I don't mean pages, because any record could be multiple pages, but 16.4 million records were classified in one calendar year. Since Bush came into office, he also reversed an executive order from President Clinton that would have released every classified document that was 25 years or older in the late 90s. So that would have gone to 47, say, to about 97, you know, and then back 25 years. But anything 25 years or older would be released. That was delayed up until the time of Bush's election. Now he has delayed it even further. It's never been implemented, but John Dean, in a talk recently about the impeachment, noted that had that been implemented, a billion records would have been released. Not a billion pages, again, a billion records. To get an idea of the scope of how much they are burying of your information and your history, I live in Anacostia, which is southeast D.C., and not too far up the road from me is the Maryland line, and right over that line is Suitland, Maryland. In Suitland, Maryland is the National Military Archive for the National Archive and Record Administration. These are the military files since the end of World War II that have been classified. They are kept in underground buildings. Each building is an acre in size. There are 27 buildings. 27 acres of buried documents solely on the military classified history of this country since the end of World War II. In addition to that, we don't know our own history from that, and some of the people that were brought in to write the history of World War II, the official history, at the Army Historical Division were 26 official historians for the Reich who made connections through Douglas MacArthur and his intelligence staff, which was run by a fascist, and he brought number of these historians here in the United States, covered their Nazi past by giving them jobs in the Historical Records Division of the Army, and they wrote the official history of World War II. One of them was sent on a temporary duty order to write the Warren Commission report. And I found that when I went into the files. And the investigative staffs of the Warren Commission argued with almost every page of that report. Where did he get this conclusion? What is this based on? And they at least released with the Warren Commission, because there was a discussion with Hale Boggs and Dulles near the end. And Boggs said, now, if we just release this report and these conclusions and we don't have any evidence, it's going to look a little fishy, ain't it? And Dulles said, go ahead and release them. Nobody will read it anyway. And so 8,000, not the entirety, but clearly, but 8,000 pages of their evidence and interviews was released, which puts the Warren Commission ahead of the 911 Commission report, which has over 100 pages of small print footnote at the back, and except for the few cases where it refers to an article in a magazine or a published book, every interview, every piece of evidence, every document, even if it wasn't classified before, is now locked up until January 2nd, 2009. A strange date, 4.5 years from when they ended, since they can lock it up for 30 years. We pushed them to release it, and this was their compromise. But it's not much of a compromise if you think what's happening on January 2nd, 2009. You're in the waning days of the current administration. There's no political cost to them to reverse this order, and by that time we will have forgotten that the 911 Commission gave Bush the power to do so. So that evidence at least could then be compared to the report. In addition to that, at least 5,000 records have been reclassified by the Bush administration, which has teams going through the National Archives looking at records that have been released and putting them back under this secret rule. So by the time you could catch up, even if you said release everything tomorrow and they reviewed it, you'd already be ahead of yourself in the years that it would take to do that with the new classifications. It got to be kind of amusing because over the 30 years that we were getting documents loose from the FOIA, at one point, one document was released with the redactions, the blackouts with the black magic marker, and then the same document would be released later with redactions, but if you put the two of them side by side, you could read the entire document. because the political reasons for what they were covering up 30 years before were not the same as in the modern day. So it's an arbitrary level of secrecy, but it's a secrecy that puts us in the position of not being able to know what's happening in our country. Martin Schott says in his book, History Will Not Absolve Us, that the political paralysis in America derives from the fact that we're allowed to believe anything, but to know nothing. And when you cannot know, you cannot responsibly act. A people whose history is buried from them is a conquered people. That's what conquerors do. And so by allowing history to become a commodity of the national security state, by letting them replace transparency, which makes democracy and accountability possible, with secrecy instead, we come to a situation on 9/11 where the American people don't know what has been done around the globe in the last 50 years in their name, and therefore don't know why anybody would be angry at them. But the coups and the assassinations and the grabs of resources are known to the people in the other countries who see the American hand come and go and understand the role that's carried out on behalf of the American people while we're kept in the dark for the most part, unless we want to know.
You heard part one of an hour-long talk by the researcher and lecturer John Judge, co-founder of COPPA, the Coalition on Political Assassinations. John Judge was recorded by Active Ingredients in April 2006 at Smith College in Northampton. Come back to hear the second part of this talk when TUC Radio returns. John Judge will present the timeline of the assassination of Martin Luther King and talk about his work as legislative aide to Cynthia McKinney to open the secret archives, not just of the surveillance of Dr. King, but also of the hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur. Shakur was under government surveillance up to and during his murder. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links to more information. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for the information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this one-hour talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.